Hello there, and a very warm welcome to Des's Island Discs. In a hectic world, this is a little oasis of calm and nostalgia from our guests who choose pieces of music that remind them of a particular time or story from their life or career. Now, if you're listening on podcast, we cannot play the music because of copyright laws, but really, this is about stories, so let's hear them. Today's guest is writer, broadcaster and Sunday Times journalist, one of Ireland's most respected commentators on politics, culture and social affairs. It's a pleasure to welcome Justine McCarthy. And Justine, perhaps unusually, anthems and symbolism feature in your first choice.
That's right. Looking back over my very lucky career as a journalist, I've been really privileged to witness some extraordinary moments in history unfold, particularly Irish history. And one of the most poignant moments that I remember happened in the summer of 1996, when Mary Robinson, who was then the president, made the first official visit to Britain as an Irish president. And as part of that, she visited the Queen, Queen Elizabeth, and had lunch with her and Prince Edward at Buckingham Palace. But when Mary Robinson and her husband, Nicholas, arrived at the palace, the Irish guards played a beautiful medley of Irish tunes. I remember the Wild Colonial Boy was one. It was like a map of Ireland they made through music. They played It's a Long Way to Tipperary, Derriere, and various other songs. But then they played the Irish National Anthem, and it was the first time that it had been played in Buckingham Palace. And it was a deeply moving experience. I remember looking over at Dick Spring, who was the Tánaiste and was accompanying Mary Robinson on the trip, and at Bride Rosny, Mary Robinson's special advisor, and at Mary Robinson herself, and seeing the depth of emotion in their faces. Now, I presume that RTE has certain protocols about playing the national anthem. So I'm not going to ask you to play that, Des. I was thinking, what is my second anthem? And I was also thinking, I'll never be allowed back into Cork if I don't ask you to play the anthem of the People's Republic of Cork, which is, of course, The Banks of My Own Lovely Lee, which I always associated with hurling matches as a child in our all-female sports mad house. We used to draw the curtains in what we call the lounge for every hurling match, when Cork, of course, were in their prime. And it was really when I was at the funeral a couple of years ago of my dear Aunt Peg McCarthy. As her coffin was being carried out of the church, a tenor sang The Banks of My Own Lovely Lee. And it was the first time I realised this isn't just an anthem. It's a magnificent song. And it's a really meaningful song. It's not just the Cork version of Dublin in the Rare Old Times for Dubliners. It's just something that really gets into your heart and speaks of who you are and what you come from.
Sean O'Shea's version of The Banks of My Own Lovely Lee probably gives us all a sense of place, Justine, that everybody has of their counties, and maybe young Dubliners who don't understand why some of these songs are so popular for the Irish diaspora. You know, when Irish singers go abroad, it is that sense of place that's so important, isn't it?
It is absolutely, and music and traditional Irish music is deeply embedded in our culture and our folklore and our history. And there's a very interesting debate bubbling away now about whether we need to actually find a new national anthem or rewrite the existing one to make the Republic a more hospitable place for Northern Unionists, and maybe for future generations across the island in Ireland, in the event of ever creating a united Ireland again.
So, and do you think there should be a new version?
I think there's definitely an argument to be made in favour of it. You know, we tend to grow up just knowing the tune of our national anthem. Some of us were lucky enough, I suppose, to be taught the words in school, but you kind of just recited it without thinking about it. It's when you actually listen to the words you're singing, they're actually not very nice.
It's military kind of, isn't it?
It is, and it's bloodthirsty, and it's aggressive and hostile, and that doesn't probably reflect the sort of Ireland that we want to create, an island of inclusivity and tolerance.
Well, the IRFU, as you know, use Ireland's Call, and when it came in, which you'd obviously remember when Phil Coulter wrote it and it was introduced, for the very reason you say that the unionists who play rugby for Ireland could feel comfortable, there are those who, oh, I hate Ireland's Call, I just want Aaron Nevine to be played. But Ireland's Call is an attempt at doing that, isn't it?
It is. And I remember there was great resistance to Ireland's Call when it began. I think the Munster players in particular might have been quite resistant to it. But I think it has grown in popularity. And as the generations have come up and they never knew anything other than Ireland's Call at rugby matches, it's become much more acceptable. And I think an example of how accepted it is now is that it is the actual phrase that's used for the COVID-19 call to arms, you know, the Ireland's Call website by the state, because it has a resonance now. It is part of our culture. We need time to adjust, but we do adjust. We're versatile people.
We are, but what about people who would say, Justine, that Aaron Nevine is our tradition and our history?
Yes, I agree with that. So I don't think we should do anything rashly or impulsively, like anything to do with the planning the future of our country. We need to have long discussions and debates and to have everybody's opinion heard and teased out. There are arguments on both sides. I suspect the argument in favour of a new anthem will eventually win out, though.
Well, the banks of my own lovely Lee will never have to be replaced as a Cork anthem, will it?
Oh, you would risk your life, Des, if you suggested that if you cross the border. Well, actually, the banks is such a lovely sort of pastoral song. It is a peaceful song. Maybe we should adopt that as our national anthem.
I don't know. It was never peaceful to me when it's been sung on Parnell Street after an All-Ireland final by Cork fellas with a few pints in them. Well, your second choice couldn't be more different from that chat we've just had about anthems and symbolism. And it's going back to your youth.
Way, way back to my youth. And let me say, even though I chose this song, it doesn't necessarily mean that I like the song. I think that was probably part of the remit when you asked me to pick three songs that I associate with certain events or times in my life. The song I've chosen is Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick by Ian Dury and the Blockheads.
An appalling choice.
The reason is it is a sort of an iconic song for my generation. Mm. I was a teenager in the time of punk rock, of dungarees, bungalow blitz and a harp and line. And I remember as a student, a journalism student in the College of Commerce in Rathmines, a group of us friends went to Belfield, to the bar in Belfield, which in itself was a very adventurous thing to do, to hear Ian Dury play. And he was an extraordinary person. He sang these songs with the weirdest titles, like Reasons to be Cheerful Part 3 and Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. Mm. And he didn't look like a pop star and he didn't sing like a pop star. He'd had polio as a child and I think his arm and leg had been affected by that.
Yes.
And it gave the impression of a really deep thinker and somebody who was born grown up compared to the rest of us that we thought we'd never grow up. And that song, Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick, almost became an earworm from my generation. You know, once you heard it, you couldn't get it out of your head.
How did you find coming to college in Dublin?
Oh, so exciting. I remember watching Peyton Place in Bandon before I packed my suitcase and came to Dublin, and thinking this was going to be my life. I was going to this really glamorous place, this sophisticated metropolis. And it didn't let me down. It'll tell you what a sheltered life I'd had. I thought Dublin was so exciting. We used to go and sit in the window of Jonathan's Cafe and eat banana splits until they came out our ears, thinking we were the height of sophistication. Because it's a city that's big enough to me to still be exciting and to have unexplored corners, and yet small enough to never feel lost in it. There's always a friendly face, or you'll always eventually bump into somebody you know.
Yeah, and the world of journalism has changed greatly. I mean, for women, as you said, it was very much a men's domain back then, wasn't it?
Massively. I started my newspaper career in the Irish Independent, and in those days, and even not so long ago, women reporters were not allowed down to where the printing presses were, because we might distract the printers. I mean, we were told this. it was that blatant. Women in those days still were sort of pigeonholed as lifestyles features writers who did fashion and cookery columns. We weren't the hard-nosed reporters. News editors were still scary, screaming men with red faces. I do remember reporters used to go to Dockers bars early in the morning. You know, they had those early morning
early
licenses.
Houses, yeah.
They'd go and have their pints there in the morning before coming into work or on a break. It beggars belief that any work or legible or coherent work was actually done, but it was.
Did you have to fight your corner a lot?
I think so, yeah. I think we had to prove ourselves again and again and again. It was very hard to get outside your pigeonhole. You were sort of patted on the head and told, there, we can't do without you, doing your features or whatever it was. So it was very hard to get into news or politics. I mean, I remember there were no women photographers at one stage in the Irish Independent. There would have been no women sports reporters. I think Moira Tynan was the only sports
That's
reporter
right.
in the Irish press going back then. People like Geraldine Kennedy would have really, broken down barriers by becoming political correspondents and political editors. It took a long time, and it hasn't changed entirely to my satisfaction yet. I know we've had women editors, but we shouldn't be able to name them on a couple of fingers of one hand at this stage.
But sport, for instance, is one where there's been a huge change. I mean, even here, my colleagues, some of our strongest colleagues are women.
And very, very visible in broadcast sports journalism.
Yeah.
Not so much in print.
I wonder why that is.
I think the need for visible balance is probably a very good motivator in broadcasting. People's eyes have been attuned to recognizing inequality on their televisions. Mm-hmm. If you tune into a program and it's an all-male presenter lineup and an all-male panel, that's going to look very outdated now.
Yeah. To move back to your journalism career again, Justine, you've chosen a piece, You Two and Ash, Don't Let Me Down. And again, it's around such a massive moment in Irish history.
That's right. In May 1998, this was the month after the Good Friday Agreement was signed, Northern Ireland was having its referendum on approving the agreement. And the Republic was having the referendum on amending Articles 2 and 3 of the Constitution, which up to then claimed the territory of the North. And the amendment was changing it to an aspiration. And in order to urge a yes vote in the North, there was a free concert organised in the Waterfront Concert Hall in Belfast for over 2,000 school children from both Catholic and Protestant schools in the six counties. And that was really symbolic for starters, because segregated education had been one of the great sort of trenches of the Troubles. Mm-hmm. It was one of the great impassable divides between Catholic and Protestant in the North. So having school children from Protestant and Catholic schools come to this concert was really important. And the concert was primarily being given by a Northern Ireland band called Ash. They were from Downpatrick. But U2 got involved in it and said that they wanted to come along as well. And the whole thing became a massive event. Bono, who comes in for an awful lot of criticism these days, did something extraordinary that day. He brought together David Trimble, the leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, and John Hume, the leader of the SDLP, on the stage in the waterfront. And they shook hands for the first time. Bono standing in the middle of these two middle-aged men who were wearing their shirts and ties on either side of this massive world rock star. Bono took a hand of each man and raised them in the air. And it was like, it was almost 1960s flower power. And it was such a moving thing to see.
I would like to introduce you to two men who are making history. Making this history. Two men who've taken a leap of faith out of the past and into the future. We want to join them, but first, we want them to join together with us on this stage.
As part of the concert, U2 sang with Ash. They sang that Beatles song, Don't Let Me Down. And they had, within it, they sang the refrain of John Lennon's Give Peace a Chance. That's exactly what those kids and their parents and their grandparents went out and did after that. The referendum subsequently was passed by 71% of people in Northern Ireland who said yes to the Good Friday Agreement, 29% no. And in the Republic, it was overwhelmingly passed. I think it was more than 90% of people said yes to amending the Constitution. And I remember that day at the concert, Bono saying that John Hume and David Trimble had taken a great leap of faith out of the past and into the future. And that was recognized a couple of months later by the Nobel Academy when they awarded Trimble and Hume the Nobel Peace Prize.
Wonderful memories. Justine McCarthy, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.